We know that a changing climate is already affecting the plant world in many ways. There are changes in rainfall, drought, pests, and fires, just to name a few. But what we didn't know until now is that an altered plant world can increase the pace of climate change, leading to unpredictable outcomes. Isabel Montañez is from the UC Davis Department of Earth and Planetary Science. Dr. Montañez is a geologist, president-elect for the Geological Society of America, and helps edit a number of scientific journals. Isabel is the lead author of an important study published October 24, 2016, in the journal Nature Geoscience. A group of scientists managed to study an ancient time relevant to our own. Their results from hundreds of millions of years ago are not comforting. Isabel, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, and thank you for having me.
Now, in the history of Earth's climate, what period did your international team of experts pick to research, and why?
So, as you know, we picked a time very far back, 300 million years ago, and most people would ask, why would anybody put much effort, or could they put much effort in a time so far back? And the answer is, for us in particular, that this is the last time that the Earth was in what we call a climate state of an ice house, and a time when we have ice sheets at our polar regions. And these ice house times are, it turns out, are actually pretty rare in Earth history, and they're also very sensitive. They're sensitive to things like global warming. So we have developed over the past couple of decades a lot of expertise in this time period, this last ice house, and that's the primary reason that we focus there. But I think I'd like to say something about studying past times in general, because when one goes back to times that were well beyond when humans were roaming the Earth, we get a far bigger picture of what the climate system is capable of. And we are now in a condition where we haven't been in terms of our atmospheric CO2 for minimally 3.5-4 million years. And we could, within this century, get to a conditions of CO2 that we haven't seen for 34 million years. So we have to go back and look at deep times, we call them, or past times, to really get a sense for how things may go towards the future.
But we have no bubbles of air in the ice cores that far back. How did you manage to reconstruct the climate and the plant worlds for a period of 16 million years so very long ago?
Exactly. Well, that's true, and I see that you have had Bob Spicer on as a guest, and he's a great person to have had, I imagine. And as he's mentioned, we do use things like fossilized plants. We also use minerals that grew in ancient soils, and it turns out that the fossilized plants in particular have a high potential for being really well preserved, and some of the samples that we're looking at look like they came off the forest floor from a month or two ago. They're so incredibly well preserved. And what that means then is that we can use these tools that are very sensitive to atmospheric CO2, the amount of CO2 that is in that atmosphere. And so we do use that. We use plants. We use the chemistry of plants. And then when minerals form in soils, they are connected to the atmosphere through the processing of CO2 by plants. So we can use those as an independent a proxy, we call them, or monitor of what CO2 was doing in the past.
I find it amazing we have to go back around 300 million years to find a time when we had big ice caps at both of the poles. You called it an ice house world. Can you describe it a little for our listeners?
Yeah, so ice house worlds, and actually I'm going to step back and say that there are two types of climates that Earth has experienced since its very beginning, and those are greenhouse times when we just don't have ice on Earth. We might have little glacial mountain caps somewhere, but generally there are no big ice sheets. And those have actually been our more common climate state on Earth. And then we have these things called ice houses. Ice houses being times, usually times that are long-lived, millions of years, where we have big ice sheets at the poles, and we live in one of those right now, and that particular time began 34 million years ago. But the last time that was on Earth was when this period that we studied, 300 million years ago, and all the time in between has been a greenhouse. the thing about studying our more modern ice house is that the CO2 levels have been much, much lower. So if we want to look at a time where CO2 might be as high as we could get to in the next 50, 100 years, then we have to go to that last ice house.
And the title of your paper talks about pCO2. What is that, and why use pCO2 instead of just CO2 for carbon dioxide?
So CO2 can be a liquid or a gas. And if it's a gas, we refer to it as pressure. And that's what that P is. It's partial pressure. So it's how much of the atmosphere do we feel as CO2 versus as oxygen or nitrogen.
Okay, let's get to the results of this paper. Isabel Montañez, what happened to the tropical forests around 300 million years ago?
I don't know that most people appreciate that all the coal on Earth, maybe 90% of that, formed from the burial of these tropical forests that were actually our first tropical forests that the Earth has witnessed. And these were these tropical forests 300 million years ago. They were incredibly expansive. They were all through the tropics and probably at times covered a third of the land that existed at that time. And so these forests are, turns out, quite sensitive to climate. And that is what initially triggers these changes. The climate warms. It tends to get drier throughout much of the tropics. They respond, and then it becomes sort of a domino or a cascading effect.
And how did the changes in tropical forests impact the atmosphere?
Plants harbor or sequester, we like to refer to, a lot of carbon. And they do that by their process of feeding and making plant matter, and that we call photosynthesis. So plants absorb CO2. They have these breathing pores on their surface. And in fact, those breathing pores are really important because those are the ones that we can actually study to see how much CO2 there was in the atmosphere. So they take in CO2 and then they process it through photosynthesis and they make this cellular material. And typically that cellular material, once the plant dies, will rot or decay, and that carbon that was now sequestered in the plant is released back to the atmosphere. But if plant material can be preserved, maybe buried in swamps, in permafrost, and also in some wetlands, if it can be buried away, then we basically take that CO2 that was in the atmosphere and we hide it away for long periods of time. So in this particular time, these forests were capable of harboring or sequestering enormous amounts of CO2 from the atmosphere. And everything was good until climate changes. And once they are disrupted, that process is disrupted, that CO2 ends up remaining in the atmosphere. And that leads to more climate change, and that's where the domino effect is triggered.
What drove that process where tropical forests flourished and then died back?
Presumably there's something else in the background working to change CO2. We know that's always been the case in the past, and even when we look at the last million years, we can see that CO2 was going up and down with our times of more ice and times of less ice, it was going up. And we know that was a natural process. There weren't any humans to burn fossil fuels to increase CO2. And a large part of that is actually the forests doing it themselves. Whether there's an initial trigger, no doubt there is. And in part, those are other natural processes like the change in the way that the Earth orbits around the sun, and the tilt of the Earth's pole, rotating pole. Those all are natural things that change on a regular basis. But the real driver is essentially the changes in the plants themselves, once the trigger is set.
That's astounding. Well, while all this was happening, what about changes in sea level?
The thing about this study that was very interesting to us is that we started out actually with a goal in mind that isn't exactly what we came out with, and that goal was to better understand what plants can do to climate. We know from studying the more recent that they can have a huge impact on climate, but I'll leave that for a little later. But what we found in the process is that as the plants were changing, and by changing, I should stress that what they're doing is they're migrating and they're dying out. So you maybe you can imagine a a time where there's lots and lots of these tropical forests and they're very lush, and then the climate warms, dries out, and they die back, and they're replaced by, we call them opportunistic plants, sort of weedy plants, those that grow fast, but that don't sequester that CO2 as well, but that are really resilient and robust when it's dry. But they feed back on the climate differently. So we have these big changes going on, and we knew this was happening. It could happen. We wanted to understand then what it would do to feedback climate. But what we also learned was that sea level was changing dramatically. The regional climates were changing dramatically. And that's all part of the climate system's response. When it warms, ice melts back, and that melted water has to go somewhere, and it goes in the oceans, and sea level rises. And when the climate ameliorates and gets cooler, and the ice grows back, that water is taken out of the oceans and put into the ice sheets, and sea level goes down. And so what we see in this particular time period is these pretty large-scale sea level changes. We're talking tens of meters of change with these CO2 changes of 200 parts per million or so during times of peak versus minimum ice. And the important thing, I think, is that these changes in CO2 are all within the range that we anticipate with business as usual from fossil fuel burning. So it really does say that sea level can rise more than a meter in response to a doubling in CO2.
Radio EcoShock.
Which proves that for pure chilling horror, nothing can beat cold, hard facts.
From the University of California, Davis, we're speaking with geologist Dr. Isabel Montañez. She's led a team which uncovered unsettling news about the ways deforestation can lead to destabilization of our climate. Your research covered millions of years. That's a very long time. Isabel, did you find signs of a climate shift at a pace anything like humans could be creating now?
So there's no question that the natural swings we see in this study are certainly within the range of what humans and fossil fuel burning, deforestation, could do in our future. That's depending on what scenarios we follow in our future. But if we do business as usual and we look at burning through at least most of their fossil fuel reserves and resources, then absolutely we're looking at CO2 that could go well over 550, 600 parts per million. Left unabated, it could be 1,000 parts per million. And the changes we saw are even less than that. They're within the range of 200 to 500-600 parts per million. So, but the key thing that all these studies have revealed is that in the past, when we study times of climate change, including the one that we did, we see things happening at least an order, if not, in this case, probably two orders of magnitude slower rates than what has been happening in the last 100 years and what presumably will continue at a fairly similar rate until we have a very different scenario. So, yes, it is relevant in terms of process. It's relevant in terms of documenting the magnitude of change, climate change that can happen, sea level change that can happen. But it also, once again, reveals a message that is how fast humans are altering our Earth in comparison to our natural past.
And you mentioned upper limits, and I noticed looking through your past papers, one asks, was atmospheric CO2 capped at 1,000 ppm over the past 300 million years? Was it?
Well, so over the last 300 million years, no. We know that it has crept over 1,000. It's probably even approached 2,000 when dinosaurs roamed the Earth, for instance. And certainly 55 million years ago, when there was a lot of CO2 released to the atmosphere fairly rapidly, more rapidly than in this study's case, it crept up further. You know, about 2,000 is probably reasonable. But in the ice house times, for CO2 to go very high is unusual because ice is just not stable. And in fact, that's what our study shows, is that ice can change, can melt back dramatically when CO2 creeps up over 400, 500, 600 parts per million.
And as I said in the introduction, forests in many parts of the world are already in trouble. It isn't all climate change, of course. We have massive logging for wood and paper. Forests are cleared for agriculture and cities. Does it matter what causes the destruction of tropical forests for this climate feedback to start operating?
Right. So, I want to take the opportunity here. I actually really like this question. Take this opportunity to actually, if it's okay, to kind of give a two-part answer. The one directly to your question, it's interesting. I think most scientists didn't think it really mattered, but there was a study that came out maybe a month or two ago that really pointed out how it does matter. And it comes down to the interconnection of things. I mean, that's the Earth system, right? That it's everything is interconnected. And what this study of the Amazon basin showed is that it's not just about the deforestation area itself, but it's the interplay with those areas adjacent to it. Are there small villages? Are there larger semi-urban areas being encroaching on those? Are there river systems? How are those polluted or not? How has the deforestation been done? And so it turns out, apparently, it actually is very important how it's done, both in terms of space and in approach.
And from what you've seen in the record of the ancient past, can we guess how much tropical forests need to diminish before this big climate feedback kicks in?
Right. So this is where I'm going to mention there's actually another climate feedback, and that's probably even more important. And it is one that we initially were chasing with our study, and we did find exactly what we anticipated. Oh, I shouldn't say exactly what we anticipated. We certainly found that it's an important feedback. And that is that most people don't appreciate that the forests of the world today cycle about twice a year all the water vapor in the atmosphere. That's a huge amount of water movement, and with that, heat energy, and it makes it impacts our climates, especially our regional climates, tremendously. And what our study showed, as others are starting to show, is that because plants can't migrate, they can't move like animals can, not as fast, they have an ability to change their functioning, the way that they move water through their leaves, the rate at which they feed effectively or photosynthesize. And in doing so, they change the water cycle. They change the CO2 in the atmosphere. And we call this ability to adapt plasticity. It's literally an ability to be flexible. But what we didn't appreciate, because studying modern plants and the recent past, there hasn't been that much climate change to really see the difference. But what we've learned in our study, and a few others are coming out with similar things, is that this plasticity can be huge. And it means that these plants, like in our case, these really lush, robust tropical forest plants, were able to move lots of water, cool the planet, take up the CO2 and sequester it. But when the opportunists moved in, they don't do it as well. And they are drought tolerant, so they close down their water transfer. They don't photosynthesize as efficiently. And so now that water has to go somewhere, and it means we have more drought or locally dry, probably more seasonal climates. It means we have more runoff into streams, into the ocean, which is not a good thing in that it can cause bacterial blooms, things like this. So these feedbacks, they're pretty complex, but they have an enormous impact on what plants can do. And for our current forests, we don't know the answer because we haven't really modeled them effectively. We don't know what these feedbacks will do in terms of then setting off more climate change and maybe setting off further impact on the ecosystems. And so we can't really answer how much of the forests can we lose before we set off this trigger, this sort of domino effect.
This is new research. I presume previous reports by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change did not include such a large-scale feedback from plants. and that probably means any carbon budgets and predictive pathways are underestimated. They will need to be adjusted. Would you agree?
Absolutely. They have not, and that's because the models themselves, the climate models that are used by the IPCC to try to project future climate, haven't yet been able to incorporate these kinds of feedbacks. There are a few that started and that are referred to in that latest report that came out a couple years ago, but it'll be the next report that I think we'll start to see some of the more sophisticated feedbacks that are included in there, and I think we'll see that they'll make big differences.
On a personal level, you know, I fear nature will take over from human drivers in a wrenching shift in the climate, and at that point, we couldn't stop the big change. Isabel Montañez, do you worry about that, and are we already there?
So those are, things that we call thresholds, and there are many different climate thresholds on Earth. We probably have crossed one. I think most climate scientists will agree that the sea ice up in the Arctic, the loss of summer sea ice, perhaps permanently, that's one that we probably have crossed. We probably haven't crossed many others. You know, the people keep an eye on Greenland ice sheet. Will that collapse? If we continue on business as usual, there's no doubt we're going to cross thresholds. And as we cross thresholds, we typically create new feedbacks, these domino effects, which just then amplifies things. Do I think we'll go there? I think I still have hope in humanity and perhaps in particular in technology. I think we certainly have the technology coming on board to artificially sequester CO2, take it out of the atmosphere. It just hasn't started. It's expensive. But I think we're starting to finally get the attention of the world in general and Americans in particular, and I think we won't stay on the business as usual for certainly not hopefully through this entire century.
Isabel, what can we do with this new science about plant feedbacks now that we know?
Well, I think scientists knew that they certainly appreciated this plasticity in plants for about two decades now. They've been studying short-term effects, and what is really important, I think one of the main messages from our study is how those have to be incorporated in these new generation models. It's challenging. It requires many, many, many thousands of lines of code, probably tens of thousands, because it's very dynamic to model. But I think that's probably one of the most important lessons here is that we can't ignore just how big the role of our plants on the land are in terms of setting our climates and our CO2 levels.
We humans do have a limited time to reconstruct what we need to know. Should we just continue to recover the whole past history of life on Earth, or do we need to focus on times that matter to our predicament now?
And that is the million-dollar question that scientists and funding agencies have been discussing at workshops and such, because, of course, there's not enough time and there's not enough money. And the answer is it's difficult to come down to a yes or no. I think I'd like to really reiterate and stress that we are already at a climate state that we haven't observed for 3.5 million years. And almost certainly we're going to go to one within the next several decades by the end of the century that will be somewhere between that 3.5 million year period and potentially as far back as 34 million years ago. And what we have learned in studying the past, including many other different time periods, is just how diverse Earth's climate system is. And what we've learned from studying the more recent, and I even mean the last maybe 100,000 years, is that it is such a small window of climate's potential for change and how ecosystems respond and regional climates respond. So we have to look at the past, the deep past, to really understand the full range. And that's the only way we're really going to understand what is a potential climates of our future in this evolving CO2 environment we're creating.
Is there anything I've missed you'd like to tell our listeners?
No, I think we've covered most. I thought it was interesting. You did mention to me earlier in a question that what does it feel like to tramp back in the deep past, and I thought I'd comment that we're all forensic scientists, those of us studying the deep past climate, and And it's just phenomenal to be able, because these are nature's natural experiments that we can tease out by chemical means and physical means, biological means, and it reveals wonderful secrets of the past, including just how robust the climate system is and how really a phenomenal interconnected system it is. So I suppose the message of that is just how important it is to take care of that and sustain that system.
We've been talking with Isabel Montañez. She's a Chancellor's Leadership Professor with the UC Davis Department of Earth and Planetary Science. Isabel is also the lead author of the paper, Climate, PCO2, and Terrestrial Carbon Cycle Linkages During the Late Paleozoic Glacial Interglacial Cycles. It's a bit of a mouthful. It was published in the journal Nature Geoscience on October 24, 2016. You can find links to that paper, Isabel's work, and our discussion in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info. Isabel, thank you for sharing your time and insight. I've really enjoyed talking with you.
My pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.